A fascination with historical natural history objects carefully stored in drawers, jars and cabinets in the vaults of Te Papa has led photographer Jane Usher on a journey of discovery. Her book, Nature Stilled, reveals items from our history that would otherwise remain tucked away, seen only by the dedicated curators charged with their care. We have a gallery of photographs on our webpage, rnz.co.nz/standingroomonly. Now, the book's designed by Arch McDonald and his team at In-House, who have come up with a colour-coded layout and a new font for the publication. First, though, Jane explains that she worked with Te Papa curators who couldn't wait to show her their favourite specimens.
Yes, and some of them have worked with particular species for a long time. But also the older collections are important for DNA and for all sorts of other reasons. So often the things that I found interesting, which were the handwritten labels or the age of some of the pieces of paper they were on, they weren't the things that they found most valuable. So it was a fine line between choosing things that I wanted to photograph because I thought they looked beautiful and photographing things that they wanted to talk about in terms of informing people who were reading the book, because the book's not just the images. At the back section of the book, each image is talked about by the curator. And there is so much knowledge in those extended captions that are almost like small essays that it's really important that people see the book not just as a photography book, but also as a way of learning a lot about their New Zealand history in each of these five areas.
Now, you'd assume that photographing inanimate objects like this would have to be easier, say, than portraits, Jane, but I don't think so, having read everything you went through. I mean, not least of which, birds preserved in arsenic, so no touching going on there.
No, I mean, you were always one step removed, so I wasn't allowed to touch any of the objects at all, not just the arsenic birds, but I'm not allowed to touch anything. The curators wear gloves and they move things around, and they could see what I was photographing. But I don't really distinguish between what I'm photographing. To me, they're all portraits. They're just different ways of looking at things. Like with a person, I need to get to know them and find out how I want to photograph them. And it was sort of similar with the book, that each object presented its own challenges in terms of lighting and in terms of the way they were positioned. And so they're portraits.
Arch, I want to bring you in here because Jane was just talking through some of the challenges from her perspective and the design element of this. I mean, you've worked on big, beautiful pictorial Te Papa books in the past, but I think you brought some new thinking to this one.
When Jane first came to the studio and shared all the images with me, firstly, we were establishing what this book was going to be like, what its physical form was going to be, but we also talked a lot about how we might deal with the images and sequence them. They're in obvious groupings, and that would have been the kind of the easy way at it. But we sort of felt that that could be a little expected and maybe a little boring. So we wanted to bring something else to it. So we came up with this idea that we would sequence the images chromatically, which kind of was the eureka moment, really, for the image flow. So they're all connected by colour, and we took all the files and we essentially blurred them in Photoshop so much so that they just became flat colours. So all the files became almost like colour swatches. And then we sequenced the colour swatches starting from white, ending in black, through to, white's the cream, to brown, to yellow, to green. And then once we'd had all the swatches organised, we sort of revealed what the images were, and that was our sequence. So it was sort of rather delightful. And then we printed them all out and tweaked them a little bit here and there just to get the nuance right. But it was kind of arbitrary, but it did have an organising idea.
It's quite a beautiful, gentle introduction to the book, actually, because you start with a North Island brown kiwi egg. So you've got the egg with the writing on. I agree with you, Jane. I think the writing's fascinating.
Yes. Isn't it amazing? It's so beautiful. People could really
And also the
write
age
back
and
then.
The cracks. It's each of these objects, especially the older ones, just the calligraphy and the aged, especially with the egg that you're talking about, you can actually see the damage around the cracking, the discoloration, the sort of slightly fragile little cardboard box and the packing it's in. It just speaks of the fragility of our kiwi, really.
It does. And it's a lovely start, you know, an egg. It's like, it's the beginning.
Yes.
And we end, actually, the final image is the image that's on the cover of the tui.
I'm actually really fond of the knobby argonaut too, which again is in the first few pages. The shells are just beautiful.
Yeah, it's easy to be seduced by the birds.
It sure is.
But what I found is that every collection, once you started getting into it, within the first 10 minutes, you were as interested in that collection as you had been in the previous one. So much to learn.
Yeah, some of my favourites were like the lichens and the mosses, yes. The moss specimens. I just thought they were absolutely gorgeous.
And guess that, I mean, that brings me to something that really strikes me about this. We started talking about the creams at the beginning of the book, but the colours are really intense, Jane. And did that surprise you? Because many of these, I think often they're called legacy specimens, many of them are really old, you know, so decades old. And yet the colour, and I'm sure you're not lying to us, and the colours that you present are intensely bright.
I think the oldest specimen is 1875, and that's the Piopio. And that tray of birds are sort of browns and creams, and they're really vibrant. And I just think it's a testimony to how people have looked after these specimens, how they've stuffed them and mounted them and then kept them away from the sunlight. And when you're down in Te Papa, there is no light, but also you've just got tray after tray that has been really well looked after through decades now.
I have this beautiful vision of you every time a tray comes out, because this was a very intense period of photography. You were setting up, you had your lights, didn't you? And it was pretty full on that every time something was brought out, there was just another moment for you to kind of take it in and then figure out logistically the best way to photograph it.
That's correct. And also you had to keep in mind that you didn't want all the trays of birds to be photographed as trays. There were, you know, you wanted some to be singular, some to be in groups, which species was going to look best in which way. And I also really wanted to steer away from using too much macro photography. I felt that just doing lots of wings or lots of details wasn't going to express what I felt when I saw these collections. It was seeing them as collections or as individuals that impressed me.
Arch, what are some of the images that when you first saw them really took your breath away?
The birds really are the ones for me that they're the ones that you respond to kind of emotionally, because a lot of them are extinct as well. It's hard not to respond to those images with a sort of a, you know, that it's interesting because it's sort of sad, it's kind of macabre and beautiful at the same time. So you've got all these different sort of emotions swirling around. It's sometimes hard to kind of just button down exactly how you feel about them. But they definitely do elicit a response. I loved some of the shells as well. I'm just looking now, I've got the book in front of me, I'm looking at the painted shells of the painted snail, and they're just exquisite. I mean, it's just incredible that this sort of all of this beauty just occurs in nature. Just got it figured out. It's pretty amazing.
I think it's going to be too hard for me to ask you for favourites, Jane, but hey, I'm going to do it anyway because that's what journalists do. What were some of the jaw-dropping moments for you, either when you first saw it or when you were looking back at the images that you got from it?
Actually, there were no favourites, but I have to say that the stories behind some of the birds make me respond to them differently. So there's a tray of what are called broad-billed prions, and 200,000 of them died in a winter storm in 2011. And so when you know the backstory and you see those birds, it makes you respond to them differently. Or when you know that the tray of birds like the Piopios no longer exists, that they were extinct by 1905 just because of stoats and various other things that were imported. I think those are the moments where you start looking at the objects differently. Mm. So you stop seeing them subjectively and you start looking at the story behind them. So It's hard for me to separate the things.
I completely understand. I think the fish offered you some particular challenges in terms of photographing them.
Yeah, because up until the fish, which was for various reasons left till last, things had been taken in trays on trolleys, and we had set up a small studio with this absolutely gorgeous light, which was like shooting in daylight. And so I was feeling very satisfied. I felt like I'd nailed it. And the fish are kept in these huge stainless steel tanks in a different part of Tory Street. And I just saw no way of being able to photograph them except in the jars. There are some of them in jars. And in the lunchroom, some of the people that were involved with the fishers were there, and I was discussing the issues. And one of the guys said, well, if it was only for a few minutes, we could actually take the specimens that you choose out of the troughs, and we could lay them on a sheet of Perspex, and you could use your light to underlight them. And that was like a kid in a candy shop. So I was going around these rooms with all these troughs and saying, I'll have that one, that one, that one, and that one. And then we'd take them out and put them on these pieces of Perspex. And they're some of my favourite shots because they become transparent.
We mentioned before the handwriting of the enthusiasts. Yes. And often they were simply enthusiasts, weren't they, who gathered together these specimens and lovingly wrote out the details in handwriting. I mean, it's pretty blimmin' impressive, the detail. And then you've got, I see you've got a fern collected by Joseph Banks and Daniel Solander in 1769-1770, which again is, I mean, very professional, very beautiful.
I mean, that original antique copper plate inscription that you're looking at, I don't even know that people know how to do it anymore. So when somebody like me is looking at it, and some of the little labels are tiny, and so the writing is minuscule, it's very impressive.
One of the things I took from it, I mean, you mentioned before some of the many species we no longer have, they're extinct, there's nothing we can do, and this is now the only evidence we have of them, which is heartbreaking. But also with some of the birds here that the future wasn't looking good, kakapo is an example, even the kaka too, that at the time that they were collected, it's very likely they were thinking, well, somewhere along the line, these may be the last of their species.
Yes.
And yet we've had success with that. So I found that really interesting. It is a story of the past, but it's also a story of the present and potentially the future.
I mean, you've obviously got an interest in this because of your... what bird were you mentioning?
I've got a soft spot for the kaka. I work with them at Zealandia. Yeah. So that page of deceased kaka did break my heart.
But I think once you start getting into this book, and I think another thing, because it's not in sections that relate to each collection, I think you'll find that you're going to go back and forward to the information in the back of the book more than you potentially would. And you'll start finding out the success stories about some of the conservation and the abject failures. So there's a lot of information that I think people can take away about both success and failure.
Yeah, and the good thing is too, is that end section, you know, we've got the front section of images that's... it's sequenced chromatically, and then you get to the back of the back of the book, and then it all gets museological and sorted out into categories. But the writing's not dry at all. It's really engaging, and they're fascinating little stories to each of the pieces. So it's a good read as well.
Jane, one of the great delights actually of this book too, as you're going through, is you'll come across something and you're trying to guess what it is. You have the obvious ones, like the birds and the shells and the fish, but I've got the black coral in front of me, and I was trying not to look at what it was until I could figure it out. I would never have guessed that it was a close-up, a detail of a flat black coral specimen.
But actually, Lynn, it's not even a detail. This thing is so intricate and complex. What you're looking at is at the size of a small table.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. It's just insane. This was something that Rick was so proud of, and I just could not see how it was going to be able to be photographed because it's big. And so what you're looking in that photo is probably two-thirds of it. It's a huge piece of coral.
It's a gorgeous thing. As I say, I think that's part of the fun of it, is trying to guess what it is.
And that's why I guess one of the reasons that where the chromatic sequencing works so well, because you're not in a section of crustacean or corals or whatever. You just don't know what's on the next page. So you kind of got to figure it out, which is quite fun.
Arch, another idea you brought to this book, something different. Your team designed a specific font for the text. We often forget how important a font is, but why go, I know there are thousands probably to choose from, but why go to the effort of designing one?
Well, it was lockdown. we actually went into, you know, we'd done a fair bit of work on the book, and it sort of went into a natural hiatus as we went into lockdown. And, you know, our studio was all working remotely, obviously, and we just decided, well, let's just double down on this and just love it up and go all the way and design a typeface for it. One of our, the sort of the lead designer on this book, Alistair McCready, he's actually a typeface designer, and he's got a particular interest in New Zealand monuments and war memorials. So he actually happened to have a rubbing of the Dominion Museum's foundation stone at the entrance of the old museum. And we just thought it would be just so lovely to have this, to build a typeface out of that rubbing, because obviously, you know, the majority of these pieces actually spent a lot of their life in that building. So that's where the serif typeface came from. It's got its own little peculiarities. You know, the R is quite distinctive. But then we went all the way and decided, well, let's design the body copy typeface as well. Everything about this book is actually kind of bespoke. And, you know, there's not a lot of money when you make books, but, you know, you're making a book and you're making something that sort of lasts forever, and it's sort of a contribution to the culture. Mm-hmm. So we just thought it was the perfect opportunity to kind of honour the beautiful objects and Jane's beautiful photographs, and just kind of over-deliver it.
Arch, I noticed too that with the design, I mean, producing books is an expensive business, but you've given this lots of space. You could have tried to cram a lot in. I mean, Jane's taken so many images, but many times it's a single image or a little series of images, and there's the facing page is blank.
Yes.
You've left it blank to absorb it. Was that really important to you as well, to give it room?
Absolutely. That was one of the decisions that Jane and I made in that very first meeting that we had. We wanted to give, you know, just lots of oxygen into the book. So most images sort of have a right-hand page bias with sort of a blank left page, but then there'll be lots of double spread. So there's a beautiful rhythm. Well, we tried to achieve a lovely rhythm with the way the images sequence in terms of scale, but it was really important for us to just put some air in it, and it just sort of feels like it slows the whole thing down as a reader. You know, everything just has space, and it's kind of contemplative, I think.
Arch McDonnell and Jane Usher talking about Jane's new book, Nature Stilled, published by Te Papa Press.